Mark Twain talked about liars, damned liars, and statistics, but he never once mentioned benchmarks. Coming up with an honest test built on open tools, running in an easily documented, replicable environment, and doing it for a distributed system like Kafka is not simple. I got to talk to Alok Nikhil about how he did it anyway. Listen in on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Hello and welcome to another episode of Streaming Audio. I am your host, Tim Berglund, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Alok Nikhil. Alok is an engineer on the cloud native team here at Confluent. So he works on things related to Kafka running in the cloud. Alok, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tim. It's my pleasure to be on this. Thank you so much.
You got it. What would you add to that? I gave a very short description of what you do, but what would be your longer account of your job?
Yeah, definitely. So I actually came into Confluent about 6 months ago. So prior to that, I actually worked at AWS and Cisco. So most of my work has been around building cloud native platforms, be it either in the networking space or in the database space. So at Confluent, most of my work still revolves around getting Kafka on the cloud and how best we can actually leverage our managed solution to provide our customers with high performance, high scalability, in general, just make it easy to host Kafka. So yeah, that's basically what I look at.
Nice. Now you and Vinoth Chandar recently wrote a blog post about benchmarking Kafka against Pulsar and RabbitMQ. That's a super nuclear topic for you to write about and then agree to come on a podcast about. I mean, I admire you. Because you know how stuff like this goes, right?
I mean, that's correct.
Yeah, benchmarks are a fraught enterprise. As I've always said, and I've said this publicly many times, Mark Twain said there were liars, damned liars, and statistics. I put benchmarks even after statistics on that list. And it's not like, occasionally. This is like being a conspiracy theorist. Sometimes there are conspiracies. Sometimes vendors probably just outright lie about benchmarks. I don't think that happens much, though. I don't think there are many actual, real, successful conspiracies. I don't think there are a lot of lies in benchmarks. It's just that benchmarks, it's easy to tune them to make yourself look good and your competition look bad, even if you're talking about open source things. You're competing for mindshare and adoption. It's still a competitive environment. Mm-hmm. And they always lack context. And this is why when I get performance questions, when I'm talking to developers in a community setting, I always say, hey, look, there's benchmarks in the world, but your benchmarks are the ones that matter. You have to test the way things perform in the context of your system. Yep. And that's the best benchmark. But even that is oversimplified because, as we're going to find out, there's just so much you have to know about systems to measure their performance well. So with that, Tim's philosophy and overall skepticism of benchmarks, this is fascinating stuff. And for us to dig through it, that we're going to be able to learn a lot. So just tell me, I guess, to start with, what did you set out to explore here between these three systems and why?
Yeah, I think that's a good introduction to benchmarking. You're right. I think just as a precursor to these posts, we actually, deliberated quite a bit on how exactly do we want to measure and what we actually even want to achieve here, right? So you're right in the sense that benchmarks are more often than not, are skewed in a lot of ways to the vendor that's actually putting out that benchmark. But it's also a way for people who have never probably seen either of those systems in production to actually see what they're capable of, irrespective of how they, how the numbers are put out. Definitely everyone has to do their due diligence before they actually adopt any of these into production. So with respect to just what we wanted to do with Kafka and RabbitMQ and Pulsar, we were, based on the data from the field, based on the community, we were looking at, upcoming platforms. We were also looking at Kafka's performance in general, which hadn't been benchmarked for about 6 years now. I think this was done was when Jay wrote a blog post on demonstrating, I think, about 2 million writes per second on 3 commodity machines. So we wanted to kind of look at all of the, contributions that the community had been doing over the past 6 years and how that actually impacted Kafka's performance.
Right. So it's funny that 2 million writes on 3 commodity machines, like, good point. Might be time to update that. I've been talking about that for a little bit now.
Yes.
What have you done for me lately? Yeah. So
yeah, definitely. Yeah, so that's the thing that we were looking at. And it was also a data point for, not just Confluent when it talks to its customers, but for also Kafka in general, when it's in the summits, when people talk about performance and scalability, we just needed some kind of a reference point to talk about. So that's what primarily we wanted to, establish in this benchmark. And definitely we wanted to look at the merits and the demerits of the competing systems, which were Pulsar and RabbitMQ. And we focused, primarily on these two because Pulsar is a more upcoming, competitor. We've seen their architecture is quite different from what Kafka does. And we were also very curious to see how that would play out in like an even streaming setup. RabbitMQ is historically been very popular with AMQP applications. So just the messaging for low latency is kind of where RabbitMQ fits very well. So we wanted to, focus on that and see how well Kafka performs against that.
Cool. It seems like durability trade-offs are at the heart of a lot of performance optimizations. Just as I look at Kafka, because I'll confess, I'm not your guy. I'm not really your guy when it comes to performance tuning Kafka. I mean, I can talk about the concepts, and I know where the knobs are. Mm-hmm. I definitely don't know that as well when it comes to Kafka and Rabbit. I'm happy to say that, happy to admit that. But it does seem like durability is where the money is. So first of all, am I right about that? And if so, where are the durability trade-offs in each one of these? If you could take me through Kafka and Rabbit and Pulsar, how do you see those trade-offs that are going to impact end-to-end performance?
Yeah, definitely. There are many different aspects to measuring performance and how, different systems are impacted by, the knobs that you actually have. And each of these systems actually do provide their own durability guarantees. And primarily, we are looking at durability as, a North Star in a way, because that has the biggest impact for these systems. So, for example, if you look at RabbitMQ, the message durability that RabbitMQ offers by default is very loose. It doesn't really offer much of message persistence unless you actually turn them on, which means it can, it can optimize messaging or message brokering to be almost all in memory, which considerably improves performance. So we wanted to establish the baseline for what the expected durability guarantees are across these systems. And that's why we decided to, look at all the trade-offs that each system offers. So yeah, so particularly we were looking at Kafka's and Pulsar's and Rabbit's, default configuration and how each of those fare against each other.
Can you talk to some of the trade-offs in Pulsar, understanding that this is a Kafka podcast, but certainly Pulsar aficionados are listening. So those trade-offs in ways that those aficionados will agree with.
Definitely. So Pulsar actually offers, as I was saying, the architecture is a bit different from what Kafka does. And in fact, if you look at Kafka's core, it's a series of distributed commit append only logs that are distributed across the brokers. Pulsar, on the other hand, actually offers more of a tiered approach for compute and storage, where the storage is offloaded onto another Apache open source project, which is Bookkeeper, where Bookkeeper follows more of a quorum style storage model versus Kafka, which is more just replication based durability. So that's basically where we were looking at, which is what does Pulsar offer by default in terms of recovery, in terms of how fast recovery can be done, in terms of just the failure scenarios. So because it's a quorum style replication and storage that Bookkeeper offers, and in fact, because of which Pulsar offers, we were more interested in trying to understand how you know, disk persistence actually plays an important role. For Kafka, in fact, if you look at replication, replication is pretty much the main guarantee that Kafka gives for availability as well as durability. So, you know, a lot of the protocol is centered around understanding and knowing and building for disk failures. So it doesn't necessarily assume that the messages that are being persisted to disk will stay there. So which means that it does rely on the fact that every time, let's say, a broker crashes and restarts, it does know that there could be some messages that were never committed to disk. So the replication is built on trying to recover that from the rest of the brokers. So for Pulsar, on the other hand, we were not really sure, primarily because the documentation doesn't really explain. And in fact, you know, we even put it out in the original blog post on trying to understand what exactly Pulsar, or rather why exactly Pulsar needs to persist to disk. But from our initial, you know, pass over the code and trying to read, we feel like without persisting to disk, Pulsar cannot offer the same message durability guarantees. So that's something that we were looking at, because trying to sync to disk and wait for the writes to come back does add a significant overhead to throughput as well as latency. So that's basically what Pulsar's durability, you know, was kind of up in the air throughout the blog post.
Does anybody's benchmark involve asynchronous f-syncing ever? I mean, is that sounds unthinkable to me, but.
That's a fair point. In fact, if you think of what Kafka does by default, we actually do not flush every message to disk. In fact, Kafka's greatest win is the simplicity in the architecture, which is it leverages the OS's page cache for, you know, most of the reads. It also leverages the operating system's flushing policies. So we don't necessarily think that that's something that's a deal breaker in a lot of ways. And as you said, it's not very common for people to actually try to sync every message to disk, especially considering in the cloud, you probably have some kind of a layer like, you know, the Elastic Block Storage in AWS, which doesn't necessarily, you know, behave the same as an SSD when you try to sync to disk.
No, there are layers upon layers of lies in what successful write means when the operating system, you know, some API tells you something was written. You have no idea what that means.
Exactly.
Ever. I mean, even frankly, if you have a locally attached IDE drive, you know, in a server that you're looking at there, that's as you know, when you really dig into what a write means and were things recorded to physical medium, it's kind of hard to really know. And so
exactly.
Like you said, Kafka's approach is not to, take any of that for granted, but provide guarantees based on replication and the watermark of we don't call it watermark, but you know what messages are readable.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. So, you used a framework for this called the mm-hmm. Open Messaging Benchmark. Could mm-hmm. you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, coming back to the thing that you brought up, you know, at the beginning, which is it's easy to actually skew most of these tests, not only just the test, but just the construction of the work, the framework itself, in a way that could probably not just make Kafka look good, but could also make Pulsar and RabbitMQ look bad. So we didn't really want to tread those waters because those are really murky. So we decided to actually go along with, you know, one of the vendor neutral, that's pretty much what the community at least considers frameworks, which is the Open Messaging Benchmark. There was about two, maybe three years ago, there was a report that was put out by the Pulsar folks that used Open Messaging Benchmark, and they did start the Open Messaging project as a way to standardize benchmarking for event streaming workloads. So we wanted to see if we could actually continue adopting that. And in a lot of ways, it helped improve that framework to, you know, further help evaluate maybe, you know, more event streaming platforms that might come up or improvements in our, you know, existing platforms. So we decided to go with that. And, you know, that was actually a tricky situation for us because we, in the initial pass, it did look like Open Messaging Benchmark did not have significant commits for about a year. Oh. And so there were a lot of gaps in the way the configuration was laid out. You know, particularly we noticed that Kafka's configuration was kind of unfair, primarily because we have the concept of, or rather basically, we have the option to use multiple producers when you actually, you know, generate the workload. But Kafka's driver configuration was forced to use a single TCP connection to drive all of those producers. Oh. So yeah, so this is a big issue, especially in the cloud. So when you think of a single TCP connection in the cloud, you are limited by packet rates because of what the cloud architecture can do. So even if you use big jumbo frames and try to push as much data as possible in each packet, you're limited by the maximum throughput that you can theoretically achieve, which is way lower than what you, let's say, say about two or three producers can do on their own dedicated TCP connection.
Yeah, I think it was Larry Ellison who said the cloud is just somebody else's computer. It turns out it's also somebody else's network infrastructure, which is very carefully configured. And you normally just don't think about the fact that there are switches and there are things and they have policies and you don't get to violate those policies. So
exactly.
Yeah, that seems like that might not work out so well.
Yep.
And the funny thing, cause you say, oh, there hasn't been a lot of commits in a year. And like this, I have this visceral reaction of, oh no, it's dead, you know?
Yes.
Which is what we assume. And that's usually not wrong, but it's kind of funny that we just assume that software can't be complete. It can't be like, well, no, this is the thing that we set out to write and we don't have any more work to do on it because it works now. You know, the world around it is changing. And like you said, there was Kafka configuration that wasn't right. So probably that wasn't a good thing, but it's just funny that we assume in a tool like this, there must be significant ongoing development for it to be healthy. I don't know if that's always true, but you were able to get past that and made the decision to adopt Open Messaging Benchmark.
Yeah, that's correct. I think overall, we did notice that there were a lot of merits to it, right? Which was the way the workloads were laid out did seem sane for us, which is they were quite representative of real world use cases. Primarily, if you're looking at, for example, an event streaming platform, your focus is on how best sequential message processing is, or rather, how well can each platform leverage the underlying hardware to offer the best sequential performance. And if you think of, if you compare and contrast with a typical database, we don't really do point in time selects, with streaming solutions. So
you just don't.
Yeah, exactly. So it's almost like you never actually find any event streaming solution even implements an API for that, right? So we kind of considered that as one of the constants that we can actually measure against. So that's why we just decided that hey, this makes sense to an extent, which is to just leverage the existing workloads that the framework offers. And in a lot of ways, one of the things that we did really like about the framework was the reporting at the end, where it actually summarizes the results of the run. It did include all the relevant metrics that we wanted, which was basically to the produce and the consume rates, the backlogs that were going, if any were growing, and then the latency numbers themselves, which is the end-to-end, the published latencies. So it kind of checked all the boxes that we were looking for just monitoring. And yeah, so that's why we just decided to go with this.
Cool. And so that's interesting that you say measuring how you utilize the underlying hardware to provide the best sequential message processing performance. Could you kind of walk me through the actual tests that it does that you used? And I guess buried in that question is, this is a series of tests and configurations. Like, what is the benchmark? It's a repo. What's in the repo? What is it?
Sorry, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. So we did actually open source it, as you said, just so that the community, or anyone who's actually interested in reproducing these numbers could reproduce it. So we try to be as transparent as possible. With the test setup itself, the repo actually contains two things. One is the definitions for the workloads, and I'll just get to that in a bit. And also a deployment configuration that allows anyone to stand up a cluster in AWS with the relevant machines that we used in the blog post. So, for example, with the hardware that we are using here, we configured three brokers and one monitoring node and four clients. to perform these benchmarks. And with the brokers themselves, we actually kind of try to use the original, the yardstick that they came up with, which was the instance types. We try to focus on, what could actually be a bottleneck for these event streaming workloads. I mean, if the ideal situation or the ideal event streaming platform would probably max out the disk while still having some headroom on the CPU and not really run out of memory, considering that the consumers were keeping up with the producers. So we kind of try to focus on that to see if we could use that as a reference point and then come up with an instance type that gives you the best bang for buck, where you actually get the maximum streaming performance out of that. So that's where we looked at what the existing instance type was. And as I said, because it was not, it didn't really receive much activity for about a year. The instance types themselves kind of were deprecated. And AWS, in a lot of ways, it's funny because AWS releases new instances very, very, very frequently.
Yes.
So we actually noticed that the instance type that they used was the i3 class of instances, which is great for storage. But the funny thing is AWS already came up with another one, which is the i3EN, which is storage optimized as well as offers great networking, which I found to be almost table stakes when you actually do streaming platforms, right? I mean, if you're bottlenecked by your network, it doesn't really matter how fast of a disk you have. So it kind of really doesn't make sense. So that's where we decided that the i3EN class of instances with, we went with the 2x large, which basically has about 8 cores, 64 gigs of RAM, and a couple of 2.5 terabyte NVMe SSDs. So yeah, that was the hardware setup. And going past that, I mean, we also looked at establishing the baselines in these hardware. I mean, rather in this hardware, right? Which is how fast could the disk go? How fast could the network go? And we noticed that the disk kind of capped out at about 330 megabytes per second, which is not bad, to be fair, primarily because this is a 2x large, which is a cheaper variant of the i3EN class of instances. And AWS does this thing, which is depending on the size of the instance, which is the number of cores in the memory that you get, it caps the throughput of the disks. So that's another interesting thing that we needed to consider. And as I said, primarily, when we look at this benchmark, it's not just on anyone's machine that's running on-prem. It's in the cloud, and we need to find the best fit in the cloud for these platforms. So that's why we decided to focus on these aspects. And then we decided the i3 and 2x slash kind of suffices that yardstick.
Got it. And so when I'm looking for instances to run Kafka on in the cloud, what are my takeaways? I think I heard you say, consider network to be your limiting factor first, and then disk, and then CPU and memory. Is that basically the priority?
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Is it that simple?
Yeah, that's actually pretty much it. As I said, Kafka is, in a lot of ways, as I said, because it's a simple architecture, it doesn't really complicate things in terms of configuration. So the thing that you brought up, which is basically the memory being the least priority for this, is actually very true, especially for Kafka. One of the things that we noticed is when we switched the instance types from i3 to i3EN, for the same type of instance, which is the 2x large, they do offer significantly different amount of memory from the previous generation to the new generation. They actually go lower in the new generation because they brought the price down and a bunch of things like that, right? So for us, it was actually a lot easier to get Kafka and, in fact, even RabbitMQ up and running without much of a change to the configuration than Pulsar, which kind of takes the approach of managing its own cache, managing its own off-heap memory. So we found it a bit more difficult to start tuning it because we would see a lot of these out-of-memory crashes on Pulsar. So from that perspective, yes, I would say for someone looking to use Kafka in the cloud, I would consider networking to be their biggest metric that they have to measure first, primarily because, as you will see in the results, as I walk through the results, you'll see Kafka can really, really, really make use of the disk.
Got it. Let's talk about some of those results. What did you find?
Yep. So it just basically, before I get into that, with the workload, I could just go over a bit of the workload that we did. So the workload itself was, a typical streaming benchmark, I would say. It was not too complicated. In fact, this was very similar to the one that the Pulsar community had done about 3 years ago, which is, we had a single topic, about 100 partitions, configured for 3x fault tolerance with 3 brokers. And then we had a single message size coming in at about a kilobyte. And then we configured the batch sizes to be about 1 megabyte and give about a linger, which is basically wait for about 10 milliseconds before sending the message out from the producer. So, and we also made sure that we wanted to keep all of those durability guarantees that we spoke about earlier. So we decided to keep synchronous replication in Kafka, rather configure Kafka to do synchronous replication with setting acts to all. So you would wait for every single produce to be replicated before you actually act back to the producer. And then we decided to test across a range of rates, which was about 10,000 messages, 50,000, 100,000, 200,000, 500,000, and about 1 million. But these were target rates, not necessarily the rates that we actually achieved, but these were the target rates that we were going for. So we of course, focused on the main two things, which was the throughput that the system could push and the latency itself that the system achieved in trying to push a single message end-to-end. From the throughput's perspective, I would say Kafka actually, did the best, primarily because of the OS page cache, as well as the fact that it kept things simple. We had 2 disks, both capable of doing about 350 megabytes per second. I would say 330, rather, megabytes per second. And the theoretical, or rather the practical maximum that we could achieve without using, let's say, Kafka or anything, when we use something, a tool like DD to measure it, was about 655, 660 megabytes per second. And Kafka came really close at about 650 megabytes per second. And we did notice that there was no CPU bottleneck, and we had taken the network bottleneck out of the equation too. And we basically saw that Kafka pushed the disk to the limit at that point.
So closest to the theoretical maximum for the disks. And that, by the way, that theoretical maximum of 660 megabytes per second is the same on the hardware for the Pulsar and the Rabbit deployments as well?
That's correct. So we decided to keep the same instance types for the brokers across the board. Same number, all of that was configured to be the same. So yeah, so the hardware was pretty much the same.
Gotcha. And what kind of latency did you see at that peak?
So we actually noticed that that's a good point that you brought up, which was at the peak, because for us, we were trying to measure the stable throughput at which that, the systems weren't really overloaded. So Kafka actually, at about 600, maybe 650 megabytes per second, the latency is about, I would say, 60 to 70 milliseconds. But that is only because we're pushing the disk to its limit. Let's say we do draw.
And that's P99 we're talking, right?
Exactly. That's P99. Okay. You're right. So the only issue is basically if we start pushing the system. So for example, when we compare this to Pulsar, which was, it's a little more interesting when you look at Pulsar's performance, which was about 320, 30 megabytes per second, which is exactly the single disk throughput limit. Because Pulsar's architecture is a bit different, where they use a journal disk and they use a ledger disk. So they use a journal disk to actually write data from different partitions. It's almost like a single long append log from with containing writes from all kinds of partitions interleaved, and they commit data to it synchronously. So because of that, there's kind of head of line blocking there, where you're waiting for every write to come back before you actually move on to the next. And the ledger disk, on the other hand, that was more asynchronous, but as you would see, asynchronous means you kind of have an opportunity to batch a bit more and kind of extract a bit more of the disk. But yeah, we noticed that Pulsar's limit was completely based on a single disk throughput. Now, given these constraints, and actually just before that, RabbitMQ was CPU bottlenecked, which means we actually didn't even notice RabbitMQ come close to the disk limits, which are at about 34 megabytes per second. So given all of these constraints, where we started seeing bottlenecks of one kind or the other, we didn't really feel it fair to measure latencies at these bottlenecks. And as I was saying, it's basically the worst time to measure latency when the system is overworked. So it didn't really make sense for us to actually focus on that. So then then we decided to like look at, you know, starting to, you know, take a few steps back, reduce the throughput a bit more, look at, you know, the throughput at which all systems didn't really look like they were overworking the system. And that's kind of where was Kafka was about, I would say 300 megabytes per second. Pulsar was at about 200 megabytes per second. And then RabbitMQ was at about 30 megabytes per second.
30.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. 30. So the thing with RabbitMQ, to be fair, is it was never built to push a lot of, you know, throughput. It was the primary focus that RabbitMQ has is around latency, low latency. Clearly, and in fact, yeah, exactly. And in fact, in the latency tests that we've done so far, we noticed that RabbitMQ does really, really, really well, almost achieving P99s of 1 millisecond at that low rate.
Okay, so it really dominates in latency, and the trade-off there is it's going to cap out an order of magnitude sooner in terms of throughput.
That's correct. Okay. And yeah, so that's where we noticed that, yeah, maybe Kafka was kind of middle of the road at latency there, which is at about 15 milliseconds, I would say, of P99. Actually, 5 milliseconds P99 and P99.9 of 15. So yeah, so, you know, it was a good result for Kafka, but yeah, it could definitely do better, you know, with all kinds of maybe configuration changes that we can do in the future, or in general, maybe stuff that we can actually focus on for improvements in replication. But yeah, hands down, RabbitMQ still does significantly better than the other two platforms.
In latency. And by the way, dear listener, if you're new to discussions of benchmarks, or if you've seen this P99, P95 sort of thing, what that means is 99% of the events, you know, whatever the thing is that you're measuring, in this case, messages, had a latency of, say, 5 milliseconds or less. If your P99 is 5 milliseconds, that means 99% of the things were that number or less. And so you can get a P95, because just the probability distribution of latencies is such that you can get a P95 of an even smaller number. You know, you can get a P50, or what you'd call the median, of a smaller number than that. And so as you increase the percentile, the number of messages that you want to be that or faster, you're capturing more and more of your outlying slow events. And I think you just said, Luke, if you go to 99.9, then it goes up to 15 milliseconds. Well, because, you know, there are outliers in there and you're going to start to capture those. But exactly. P99 is a typical one. It's pretty aggressive. You know, you're saying 99% of our things are this or faster.
Exactly. I think, yeah, that was the key part that we wanted to measure. That is, you know, it's basically easy to lie by using average as your statistic, right? Which is, it's never representative of your true experience. So yeah, that's why we decided to focus on these percentiles and make sure that we had some kind of a guarantee, or at least some kind of an agreement on, okay, where do we want to focus on in terms of what the experience would be for latency.
Right. And usually these are going to be normally distributed. There's going to be a classical Gaussian bell curve to these latencies. But if you just communicate an average, there's another number, and that's the fatness of that bell, the standard deviation. How far out is one standard deviation? And with just an average, that's nice. But if you don't know the standard deviation, you don't have that. And so rather than communicate those two things and say, well, now you have to remember in statistics, when, you know, you studied the normal distribution, go do some calculus and you can figure this out. The P99 is just a good kind of standard. And frankly, perfectly honest, any vendor, any open source project, anyone doing latency benchmarks is likely to communicate in terms of that metric. And it's a pretty fair way to compare.
That's right. Yep.
Here's a sort of devil's advocate question, you know, getting back to Tim, the skeptic of benchmarks.
Yep.
Now, you can only do this by picking the same hardware and running well-configured software on the same hardware with similar workload, you know, the same workload. That's the only fair way to do this. But if you were, say you had you weren't an impartial scientist here, but you wanted to make Pulsar look good. Is there a different instance type you could have picked? What would you do there?
Yeah, I think I think it's actually easy to look at what the bottleneck was, right? Which is the single journal disk. We definitely could have picked an instance which offers, you know, one faster disk and one slow disk. Funnily though, no cloud provider does that. They either offer the same performance for all of this, or
you're saying that, and I'm thinking in the back of my mind, can you get that? I didn't think you could get that.
Exactly.
I mean, I always assume it's something I don't know. Like, there's lots of things I don't know, but right. Okay.
Yeah. So I think there is, of course, a way to do that, right? Which is basically to use a service like EBS. But unfortunately, with EBS, you don't really get the same kind of guarantees that an SSD can give you, primarily because it's a service, it's not a disk, right? So you kind of have issues with latency then. So it's almost like you're trying to make a trade-off, which is, do you go with EBS, configure, by the way, we should also be more expensive considering that you would have to provision more IOPS on EBS to kind of get the same performance. Uh-huh. So you kind of make the trade-off there where you pay more money, you're okay with spikes in latency, which means your P99 starts to look bad. And then you say, okay, now I can push as much as I want on those disks. So, you know, that's kind of the challenge here, which is for Pulsar, you could make it look good, but yeah, you would need something really, really, really specific to optimize that on the journal write path. So yeah, that's what I would say.
Gotcha. And that journal and ledger split thing makes all the sense in the world when you think about Bookkeeper as a storage system. Like, you have to do that. You have to, it's like a database at that point. You know, there's a commit log, and then you take from there and build the stuff that is your long-term storage.
Right.
And do the quorum writes, which, you know, if you're going to be a quorum system, then some of those might be higher latency writes than others because they might be in, you know, remote regions or whatever. That's how that kind of a system works. And so having that journal on the front end of it is sensible. You know, it's not just talking about it, it might sound like a really bad thing. It's a perfectly sensible thing, and it's a consequence of it's a negative consequence of the positive utilities that you're getting out of the back end of that storage system. It's designed to be distributed in this particular way, and therefore the trade-off is we've got this ledger on the front end of it. So it's not, I mean, again, this is a Kafka podcast, and I'm a guy who works for Confluent, so we don't need to pretend about what my incentives are. But right. I don't want that to sound like some obvious criticism of Pulsar. It's a different set of trade-offs, and you take advantage of other utilities in the system in exchange for that trade-off. But in terms of peak throughput, well, yeah, there you are. That's going to be a limiting factor. And at that point, then this stuff gets subtle. Like, you have to know a lot about these systems to understand the benchmarks and to make the trade-offs, and you'd have to make the decision. Are the actual advantages of that quorum write distributed storage backend, are those utilities things that I need to maximize at the expense of minimizing other utilities in the system? And of course, if you're making a decision about what of event streaming system to adopt based on performance benchmarks, when the pandemic's over and we can go out for coffee, I want to go out for coffee with you and just talk about the way you make decisions in your life, because there's more to the story than that. However, we're talking about benchmarks today, so we can limit our discussion to that.
Yeah. No, that's fair. I think that's the point that you brought up, which is fair, right? Which is, a lot of these systems, there are a lot of nuances to it. Primarily, if you look at, even, I mean, as I was saying with RabbitMQ, it's the number of configurations, or rather the way you can configure RabbitMQ, it's just crazy. It's got so many different knobs that you can play with. And of course, each of those have their own use case. It's not fair to say that they're not really relevant. But you have to be aware of what each of those options, configurations can do. So primarily, if you look at the architecture for RabbitMQ, you're looking at exchanges and queues. So they're kind of a different concept to what a typical event streaming platform like Kafka or Pulsar has. Kafka and Pulsar keep it simple. They have a topic, they have a producer, they have a consumer that's interested in that topic, right? Now, With RabbitMQ, on the other hand, you have exchanges that determine how do you route messages. And then you have queues that are bound to these exchanges that determine who consumes these from which exchange. Now, depending on how you actually, what you choose for these parameters, the performance could be either 10x or 50x. So it's huge. The range is just insane.
Got it. So there's... what that means is there's a lot of ways to run the benchmark wrong. Mm-hmm. And even the most right, most fair, most objective benchmark you can think of is probably then open to criticism.
That's right.
After the fact of, well, you set that up so that product X would look like it sucks, you know?
Exactly.
Which, by the way, after you write a blog post like this, I mean, that's your life for a little while. I started with saying, I think you're courageous.
And, yeah, it is. I mean, there were a lot of Twitter flame wars and stuff like that that started off.
That's like, you know, hey, let me go talk about what I think about fiat currency. I'm just going to go get on Twitter and talk about that. That's fine. I'm sure nobody's going to mind.
Exactly.
It'll be great and we'll all be friends. Yeah, it's not how I play it. But anyway, this actually is, as it were, scientifically necessary for us to try to understand this. Mm-hmm. And honestly, that is to some degree a broader community function, because when you do this, you do have to take that input and feedback and criticism. Mm-hmm. On the methodology, and you have to really interact with it. You know, you can't just say, no, I know Pulsar better than you, Mr. Pulsar specialist, and this is how it works. You know, you have to talk through that stuff.
That's right.
The result of this benchmark, I think if we've got time, I've got two more big questions.
Of course.
The results don't make me feel like, oh, wow, I'm embarrassed. We have some catching up to do. Mm-hmm. You know, it seemed like it worked out pretty well. And again, there are many more factors to consider than just mm-hmm. performance, but mm-hmm. you have to consider performance. It's going to drive, if you're running in the cloud, it's going to drive your operational costs long-term.
That's right.
So that matters. Even so, what's going on in the world of important Kafka KIPs? Obviously, KIP 500 comes to the top of the list, but what else is there in the world that will help move Kafka forward even more? What do you see coming up?
Yeah, so I think it's a very relevant point, which is there are a lot more broader use cases where Kafka can, of course, you know, performance might actually not be ideal for us. And particularly if you're looking at, for example, just increase the number of partitions in a topic, just basically cause more random messages to go through across these partitions. I feel like that kind of a distribution starts to hurt, you know, Kafka's performance a lot more. And we also have started to, you know, see
this was one topic, 100 partitions, you said.
Exactly. Yeah. So we can definitely do better in the larger number of partitions. And that, to be fair, is something that Pulsar can handle very well. And we've seen that in the past. We've seen that in their own benchmarks. And we do acknowledge that fact. And particularly, we see that as the whole thing that we did with measuring the performance was also for us a way for us to understand what the bottlenecks would be for Kafka in general. And we do see that, as you were saying, KIP 500 is one of those things which in the control plane, not particularly in the data plane, but in the control plane, starts to improve scalability for Kafka. Just replacing the zookeeper layer, by the way, that's KIP 500 that is, you know, replacing the zookeeper layer with a Raft consensus protocol allows us to, you know, just add a lot more partitions that a broker can support versus just limiting it to a fewer number just because of zookeeper's, you know, scalability limits. That's the primary focus of the control plane side. But once we deliver that, we now have to start looking on the data plane side. How can we start improving things? And, you know, this is where it's actually a lot more exciting, as well as a lot more, it's like if you drew a decision tree to go from here, there's just way too many paths to go through. Primarily because there are a lot of ways in which you can actually improve and focus on for performance. But if you think of what the future for computing is, what the future for storage is, you start to see, you know, a lot more cores that a single die packs, and then a lot more, or rather a lot bigger cores that a single die packs. And you also start to see these storage, trends that are starting to use SSDs, not particularly NVMe, but SSDs. And we start looking at, you know, the advantages an SSD can offer, which is it does do a lot better for random writes than a typical hard drive does, right? So keeping all of this in mind, we actually think that our bottlenecks start to show up in the replication where, you know, especially because Kafka is a pull-based replication, not push-based. So it does take adds a significant amount of overhead, especially when you have a large number of partitions that you're replicating between brokers. And because it's, you know, fully replicated across all machines, it's kind of a system where everyone's pulling data from the partition leaders. And yeah, you start to see these replication bottlenecks. So that is one of these, that's the other area that we are looking at and trying to focus on maybe in 2021 and hopefully deliver something that's solid improvements there.
So improvements in replication scale. And it sounds like, you know, to your point, KIP 500 is a control plane improvement, mm-hmm. but given that control plane improvement, mm-hmm. that exposes us to different scale characteristics in the kinds of clusters that will exist in the world. There will be more higher partition clusters once having a ultra high partition cluster isn't a bad thing. There'll be more of them, and then that's going to expose some of these other growth edges that the team can attack and optimize because of those, I don't want to call them use cases, but sure, use cases that have profoundly large partition counts. You'll start to feel the need to do that yep. optimizing that you don't feel right now.
That's right. And, you know, as you said, it's not necessarily something that's, you know, out there in the wild. We haven't really seen customers come to us and complain that, hey, you don't really support these many partitions and Kafka's performance is horrible or whatever, right? We haven't really seen a lot of data points, but what we do notice is because of improvements in supporting larger number of partitions per broker, your cost tends to come down to run the same kind of workload. So from a cost and efficiency perspective, it is still a big win. And that's kind of why, you know, this is something that we're still considering.
Final question. What do you think has been the most honest critique that you've received and how did you respond to it?
Let me think about it. So I think in a lot of ways, the Pulsar community got back to us and they said, hey, we need to, you know, we kind of went back and forth because they suggested using a faster disk for the journal. As I said, that's something that's not standard. But I think the honest critique was the fact that, we should have tried a larger number of topics, maybe start mixing workloads a lot more. Primarily, we were looking at a workload where the producer produces messages and the consumer is constantly just consuming messages. So there is no opportunity for these messages to build up, and then you go lag behind in the consumer and then pull those messages from way back in time, right? So then you start hitting the disk and a lot more of those start to come into picture. So which is basically kind of what they call the catch-up consumer test. So that I think was the biggest critique that I found was very relevant and in fact could help us introspect into Kafka's performance.
Well, I like the fact that there's been interaction there, and I hope that can continue to go on. And
yep.
as a broader community, we can help refine the way that we study this stuff and improve our tools.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's very key here. You're right. It's as I think event streaming and event driven architecture is, you know, obviously right now a very key component in a lot of companies and businesses. And I think the findings that the community has in general are going to be very relevant from one product to another. And yeah, you're right. It's just this, there is good cooperation. And then fact that, you know, there's enough checks and balances that, you know, one doesn't kind of run away and, you know, claim things that it's not true. And yeah, I think that's been a pretty good interaction so far.
My guest today has been Alok Nikhil. Alok, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Thanks for having me, Tim. It was it's a nice experience to, you know, discuss the blog post out there. It's not just the words there now, but it's also some voice to it.
Hey, you know what you get for listening to the end? Some free Confluent Cloud. Use the promo code 60PDCast. That's 60PDCAST to get an additional $60 of free Confluent Cloud usage. Be sure to activate it by December 31st, 2021, and use it within 90 days after activation. And any unused promo value on the expiration date will be forfeit, and there are a limited number of codes available, so don't miss out. Anyway, as always, I hope this podcast was helpful to you. If you want to discuss it or ask a question, you can always reach out to me at TL Berglund on Twitter. That's TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out in our community Slack. There's a Slack signup link in the show notes if you'd like to join. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover us, which we think is a good thing. So, thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.